morning, everyone. Happy Friday. This is your host, Jason Miles, coming at you from Oakland, California. This is Revolution. And this is our episode with returning guest, John Graham. Now, as the show is growing, there's a lot of people that are new to the show, new to this audio-only podcast. So if you go back, there's an episode we did, I think it's called From 1619 to the 1776 Project, right? Where we were critiquing, our attempt was to critique both projects. I feel comfortable saying this. Pascal and I are not fans of the 1619 Project in its entirety. Of course, not fans of the reactionary response, which is the 1776 Project. So we brought a historian in, Professor John Graham. And we've talked about the project on a few different episodes. But anyway, we have brought a historian in, Professor John Graham. And the moment we started talking about 1619, we had got a troll in the chat. Now, there's a lot of organic growth with this show. So, trolls in the chat are something that we're still kind of getting used to. So this was the show that actually had us go look for a moderator. It just got off the rails. And it's also the show where we started taking the chat off the screen. You know, I could see in the guest's eyes and through Pascal's glasses, he's reading the chat. And basically, before we could even really get into any sort of critique, this person is just firing off a silly defense of the project, which was a lot of it was based off Gerald Horn's book on 1776 counter-revolution. And I've had Gerald Horn on the show, which was kind of the irony of the ire of this person. Like, you know, he just, or I should say he, we don't know if it's a he or she. They were so upset and kept yelling about Gerald Horn, never quoting Gerald Horn, which I found very interesting, which kind of led me to believe they never read Gerald Horn as much as maybe have seen him on a appearance on a show or a panel or a podcast or something. And that's frustrating, especially if you never read the book. You don't really know what you're talking about if you never read the book. So anyway, John Graham was gracious enough to come back, and he actually wrote a book on residential schools, and we wanted to cover the history because, so we did a show, the last audio only podcast with Priya Gopal, where we talk about kind of the forgotten history of British Empire and how it affects the way people even view empire. You can say the same thing about America, and we definitely brought it up on the show. And it's shocking how this history has just been glossed over. When we talk about westward expansion, we always view it through the lens of an empty, vast wasteland. And maybe there were some savages here and there, but it took ingenuity of Europeans to cultivate the land, to build highways and trade routes. And when you read the real history, which I'm actually very excited, we've booked Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. This has been months in the making of getting her on the show, who wrote the Indigenous People's History of America, which really documents the fact that there was a very vibrant people living here with civilized society. And it wasn't the savage society that we see in movies and in the art of that era. Was it the Remington art? So before the guest comes on, you know, if you've listened to a few of these, you know that we play the intro video that I make. And in that intro video, I included a Time Life Books commercial. And for those of you old enough to remember, Time Life Books were like kind of a encyclopedia series of very colorful coffee table books. And they had one called The Old West. And I remember that commercial just played ad nauseum. And in touring places like Montana, you'll find in a thrift shop, they'll be selling the set. And I've been tempted a couple times to get it, but I've never really found a price I think is worthy. I always see it, you know, $20 a book or some shit like that. Are you high? Anyway, even that overly romanticized history of manifest destiny is extremely problematic when we try to reckon with empire, settler colonialism, which are, you know, terms we definitely get into on the show. So I'm going to move out of the way. This is a great show, a hilarious bonus patron app. You want to watch these live? Subscribe. It doesn't cost you anything. YouTube.com/ThisIsRevolutionPodcast. This is John Graham. We're going to talk about residential schools in the U.S. and Canada. I am out. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another edition of This is Revolution Podcast, the Tuesday edition. Started the show off with a tribute to the late Michael Brooks. Today is the anniversary of his passing. I'm, like most of you, kind of in shock. It's been a year. I was on a show that his sister... She's been on the show, but his sister did something part of the Michael Brooks Project. A gentleman named Joe Payne and I were on the show talking about Michael Brooks and his legacy. There is still a void in the left YouTube podcast sphere that I don't think will ever be filled. A mixture of intelligence and comedy who was very... His passion came through in everything he did. So you will be missed, Michael Brooks. And on that note, bringing in my homie, my dog, coming all the way from Miami, Florida. You may know him from all, I got to do the applause right now, from all the appearances he does on heaviest shows. Is he going to stay? Is he going to leave? It's like the LeBron decision right now with Pascal Robert. He is Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. Is he going to go and go to go where? What are you talking about?
Well, you know, the rumors are that you might be filling the new black guy spot at the Majority Report.
First of all, what are you talking, dude? Please.
Another rumor is that you might be the new featured black guy on the Katie Halper show.
First of all, if these are rumors, how come I'm not hearing any of them?
Because I started them. I started them, and they're not real. But that's how rumors work.
So, in other words, you're creating a crisis in your own imagination that's not real.
Yes. I'm beating the haters to the punch by causing a fake crisis that isn't real.
Listen, this is Revolution. It's our show. I'm here. We are trying to engage in serious discussions and not only provide entertaining leftist course, but serious conversations about expanding the political Overton window for regular folk in our society. I take that seriously.
Someone is asking if Pascal's been on the Katie Halper show. No, he has not yet. Yet. But Katie Halper and I are Facebook friends.
Good for you. Let's not talk about what that means. Shout out to Janice Graham in the chat.
Is Janice Graham in the chat?
Janice Graham is in the chat. She's very interested in this subject.
Well, this is a very interesting subject, and it's interesting to me for a couple different reasons. Number one, we don't learn this in school. It's only been 6 years since I left California Public High School, and never do I remember learning this in any of my California state history or any of my U.S. history about residential schools. And it wasn't until my touring travels took me to Indian country and kind of finding my way immersed in a kind of native punk scene, did I learn more about this history and how insidious it is or was. And if we talked earlier about it today with these redactions on education, right? Like, we're no longer going to teach critical race theory in school like they did in the first place. We talked about it real quick off air. Wanting to teaching the KKK wasn't bad. You can't teach slavery was bad. It's, you don't want to teach current events. This is just Texas state, but the several other states are trying to pass laws like this. Very important that we understand this history. So before we introduce our guests, let us play the intro clip. We'll be right back. There is a notion that poisons the minds of many Americans, the myth of manifest destiny, the narrative that the vast, empty western lands of what we now call the United States was an untamed wild unknown filled with savages that could only be settled by a truly civilized people. In recent weeks, there has been breaking news from Canada that mass graves have been found near what were known as residential schools. These schools were boarding facilities with a long-standing partnership between religious institutions and national governments. Their goal was to isolate indigenous youth from their families, erase their customs and language, and assimilate them to the dominant culture. In the United States, Colonel Richard Henry Pratt was maybe the most impactful figure of the off-reservation schools. His goal was that of complete assimilation. His motto that became that of the system, kill the Indian, save the man. In this episode of This Is Revolution, we'll take a deep dive into the insidious nature of the residential schools in the U.S. as well as Canada with historian John Graham. This is Revolution.
I got frightened when I was a little girl when the principal used to beat up the other children, like boys. The boys got the most beating. They used to call it bench party, and it was usually done after supper. And that's where I got frightened, because I saw blood.
I remember when we had to shower. You only have to show me how to shower and clean and wash myself, how to wash my private and private parts of your body. You only have to show a kid once or twice at the most, but not every day. You know, and have the supervisor come in there and basically take advantage of you.
Somewhere in these Chiricahua Hills, no white man will ever know where, the Apaches buried Cochise, the greatest of their great chiefs. Geronimo faded into these hills, and it took 5,000 U.S. soldiers to bring him out. And now Time Life Books brings the great chiefs to life again as your introductory volume to a fast-writing series called The Old West. Hundreds of authentic pictures give you the real story. For the first time ever, you'll be able to see Geronimo's combat dagger and Colt 45. You'll look into the eyes of Sitting Bull, the man who destroyed Custer. Quanah Parker, the fierce Comanche whose mother was a captured farm girl, and all the great chiefs. Eyewitness accounts and rare photographs and art bring the Old West to life. You'll meet the gunfighters. Men like John Wesley Hardin, so mean he once shot a man just for snoring. The cowboys, blazed in glory by the greatest artists of the Old West. The pioneers, battling the savage elements and bloodthirsty war parties. The gamblers, the women of the West. They're all here in big, handsome books with the look and feel of hand-tooled saddle leather. We'll send you the great chiefs for a 10-day examination. If you're not impressed, just return it within 10 days and pay nothing. If you decide to keep the great chiefs, you pay just $12.95 plus shipping and handling. Then approximately every other month, we'll send you another lively volume from the Old West Library for a 10-day examination. Keep only the volumes you want. You can cancel at any time. Here's how to order.
Phone toll-free 800-228-3300 or write Great Chief.
All right. Did that freak you out at the end, Pascal?
It's all this part of this disturbing history of this particular republic.
In making that, I tried to find pictures for a thumbnail, so I'd take a few pictures, and I was pretty much done once I found the Time Life commercial. There's a few. That one actually worked. And I found these pictures. I was like, I kind of want to keep this, and I figured something to do with the music to bend the orchestral notes, and it scared the shit out of me looking at that picture. It really frightened the hell out of me. So without any further ado, he's a returning guest. I do want to let him know, I forgot to tell him this before we got on air, we have a moderator now. So this show is not going to get derailed as it did last time with John and Pascal yelling at the chat. Coming all the way live from Springfield, Missouri, he is Dr. John Graham.
That just tripled my lifetime applause, I think. It's pretty exciting.
John Graham.
Yes, sir.
I want to start this off with this. Before we even get into residential schools, let's tackle the word, the phrase that you wrote a few essays about, settler colonialism. We can't really explain residential schools without explaining that. You have about 30 minutes to explain all of Native American history before the Mayflower. Go.
All right. So settler colonialism is a term that was invented to distinguish between what happens in the U.S. And Canada and South Africa and Australia from more what we think of as traditional colonialism, like maybe, say, Great Britain and India, right? So when we think of colonization or colonialism, we tend to think of sort of a temporary occupation. The point is to exploit the local population for a certain period of time to extract natural resources, and you have a very small colonial population, right? Mainly administrators, soldiers, things like that. But with settler colonialism, what you actually have is you have colonists moving in with the goal of actually replacing the indigenous population and claiming that land as a new homeland, right? So this is actually what's happening in the U.S., especially in Canada also, is we're going to come here. We're going to be the indigenous people. This is our home. And so we have to not only get rid of indigenous peoples, either literally or at least destroy a sort of distinct indigenous identity, because we're going to take that on. But we also have to deal with these land claims, right? These are not empty lands, but they're our lands now. We have to somehow destroy the ability of indigenous populations to claim those same lands, right? So that's where settler colonialism differs from other models, is it has really two goals, right? Destroy indigenous societies, whether physically or in other ways, and to destroy indigenous land claims.
So is it fair to say that there is almost an innate genocidal capacity component to settler colonialism as a project?
Yes, it absolutely, it must be genocidal to be successful, especially if we don't limit genocide to body count, right? They did a genocide so much bigger than just a huge body count. If you look at the UN's definition, it basically means destroying the ability of a people group to continue to be that people group, whether kidnapping their children, sterilizing them, right? It doesn't just mean literally going out with a gun and taking people out, which also happens, right, in the U.S. and Canada as well. Yeah, so settler colonialism doesn't require the physical extermination of indigenous populations necessarily, but it is inherently genocidal. I'm perfectly comfortable saying that.
You know, what's really fascinating about, and by the way, I really appreciate you highlighting the distinction between settler colonialism and the normative forms of colonial extraction, not that they were kind in and of themselves. It happened particularly like in Spanish, Latin America, and South America. And the first time, I think Jason remembers, the first time that I even became aware there were distinctions in these forms was reading Aviva Chomsky's book, who was a guest on our show. And she really highlights that the methodology of a colonial expansion in the United States differed greatly from what we had in Latin and South America, because in Latin and South America, the goal was actually to control the existing native populations and extract labor or resources from them. But in comparison, when it came to North America and the United States and Canada and Australia, the actual goal was complete population replacement and extermination.
Right. Exactly. So the question is, is the indigenous population a resource or are they just in the way? Right. And that's kind of the way of thinking of it.
Yeah, this is a fascinating distinction. So, John, if you can really do us a favor, let's talk about what the phenomenon that has put this discussion really kind of in the minds of everyone. And I know you're a specialist in this, in the residential schools in the American context. But can you talk to our audience in the chat about what exactly are the events in Canada around these particular institutions? Were they state institutions or church-run institutions? The recent discovery of several mass graves, or some people are debating whether they are mass graves or just simply unmarked graves. We can talk about that debate as well. But put the Canadian situation in proper context for our audience, if you can, please.
Sure. So it's not that different on both sides of the border, honestly. Towards the end of the 19th century, you have both nations sort of entering what they would consider the final solution to the Indian problem. And I'm using that phrase ironically, in the sense that, okay, so we're claiming the continent. It's clearly our land. And science at the time is telling us that they either going to become civilized like us or they're going to die out. Those are only two choices, right? And so we need to figure out a way to preserve them, to save them from themselves, but also make them useful to this new society that we're creating, right? There's no sense of cohabitation. It's not going to be our land and their land. This is our land. And if you're going to survive in it, you're going to be useful to our project. And so what happens, interestingly enough, is that Canadian officials actually travel to the United States. And at the time, the United States was still relying on religious institutions to run its schools. It hadn't yet taken over. The government hadn't taken them over yet. And they see this model and they say, you know, this could work. And so they start this huge system of boarding schools across Canada, I think mainly in the West. And what you have is a partnership between church and state. So the government is going to fund them. And the government is going to, in theory, sort of set the standards, determine what it looks like, but they're going to be run by various churches. So it's a church-state cooperation, and it lasts. Don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure Canada doesn't take back over the schools at a government level until like the 1960s or 70s. So these religious-run schools last much longer than in the United States, where you have the same kinds of schools. But really, by the 20th century, they're being run almost entirely by the federal government. And the purpose of these schools is to basically, I mean, they're genocidal. It's to destroy indigeneity, destroy the ability of these people to be Indian, to be, or First Nation in the case of Canada, and to educate them, by which we mean forcibly assimilate them and make them useful to us, which really means basically preparing them for the menial labor market.
Can you contextualize?
A lot of their jobs was like kind of learning how to be a maid, learning how to sew, the men learning how to do kind of more manual labor.
Right. It's really, really fascinating because on the one hand, you have the boy students being trained for more manual labor. I mean, in some schools, you might have some like an auto shop at some point, right? But mainly manual labor. A lot of it is farming or agricultural related. And then for the girl students, you actually are training them in domesticity. For both in the U.S. and Canadian system, the idea is that really the women, the future women, are the key, right? Because when you have a civilized, if you will, a civilized indigenous population, you have to have civilized homes, right? Cold domesticity, Victorian values, all those kinds of things are at work here. So you have the women being trained, the girls trained. How do you run a house? How do you properly clean a home like the civilized way? What kind of meals do you prepare in a civilized home? How do you support your husband, right? So that's all a whole other level here, right? Is you're really imposing the predecessor of the Cold War nuclear family onto these communal societies and the way that you're forcibly assimilating their children.
Go ahead, Pascal.
Can you contextualize the exact time period in which these institutions begin? in both Canada and the United States and how long they actually extend into in their existence?
Sure, absolutely. So in both places, right, assimilation through education extends all the way back to colonial times. I mean, on the U.S. side, right, if you look at the seal for the Massachusetts Bay Colony, it actually has a picture of a Native American saying, "Come over and help us," right, referring to the Bible story where Paul and the Macedonians say, "Come help us." So now, do the Pilgrims and the Puritans really engage in it? Not that much, but that's at least one of the official reasons for coming, right? So all the way in colonial times, you have this sense of burden that these indigenous peoples, these backwards and civilized people, they need us. That's going to continue in both countries. A really important date on the U.S. side is 1819. This is when the federal government actually establishes the Civilization Fund, by which they start funding religious schools with federal money to do this forcible assimilation through education. The Canadian side, I don't know as well at that time period, but something similar is happening over there as well. And so when we get to talk about these boarding schools, these residential schools in Canada and these boarding schools in the U.S., we're talking about really the last few decades of the 19th century. On the Canadian side, I think the last of these schools closes in like 1980 something. I mean, it's a long ass project.
I think 96 is the last one closes in Canada.
96. Okay. On the U.S. side, the particular assimilative model that the schools start with starts to get challenged in the 1930s, and just the practical economic realities of the war effort, the Great Depression, ends up closing a lot of these schools, so that the schools that survive those cuts are still assimilative in nature, but they look a little bit different. I mean, there's a lot there to unpack, but basically the U.S. boarding schools, the one, you know, there's still government-run schools today, and it's kind of a cool part of the story. Some of those former boarding schools are actually controlled by tribal nations now, who have taken over those schools. That actually, we're going to use these schools, these genocidal institutions, to actually preserve our culture and train our children. It's kind of awesome.
To flip, pretty much flip it on its head.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about the Panthers, especially even on this show. We don't really talk about AIM too much. The American Indian movement. What was their stance on these boarding schools?
Well, AIM is really, really important in trying to found things called survivor schools or survival schools and find other sorts of educational outlets for reconnecting Native American youth to their culture and to their heritage. A lot of the folks that start AIM are in some ways detribalized functionally by the experiences with the boarding schools, but also because of some government programs in the mid 20th century, where they're actually trying to destroy any sort of distinctive relationship with Native American tribes. And so a lot of their story is, hey, we're actually going to go and learn the ceremonies and try to relearn the language. And we're going to recapture those things to help our students or help our children, to recapture who we are. So yeah, so education is very much at the very heart of what AIM is trying to accomplish. And they're doing that very much in response to a lot of the just shitty legacy of these boarding schools.
John, can you explain for us the more detailed nuances of the day-to-day operations of these schools and what made them particularly damaging, both physically, culturally, psychologically, to these First Nations children?
Sure. So let's just look at the very first day of school. Okay. When you arrive at a boarding school, you're probably going to lose four things. You're going to lose your name. You're going to be given an English name of some kind. It might be something simple like John Brown, or it might be actually a name very full of meaning. Like if you look at the boarding school records on the U.S. side, you find Indian students named Ulysses S. Grant. You find one named William T. Sherman. You find one named Julius Caesar. You're like, what the hell is going on, right? Well, what's happening is they're stripping those names and giving them names that are meaningful in this new society in which they're supposed to be integrated, right? And obviously, you know, in a name is – is the hopes and the dreams of your parents for you often, right? I was named after after my grandfather and then my great grandfather because my parents wanted me to be men or be a man of that kind of character, right? So the names that you're sending these students to school with aren't just random names. They have meaning that's being erased. So you lose your name. You're going to lose your language. You're not allowed to speak anything but English at these schools. Enforcement of that could differ from school to school. If you were caught speaking your tribal language at some schools, you might have dinner taken away from you. You might be put in the school prison overnight. One Canadian survivor actually records that a sewing needle was shoved through his tongue to remind him to only speak English. So, it's pretty awful stuff. So you lost your name, your language. You lose your physical appearance, right? Your hair is going to be cut if it's long, which is a very, very important, significant cultural value for many of these tribal nations. So it's not a small thing. And then you're going to lose your clothing, right? What they don't show you... What they didn't show in the Carlisle clip that Jason used, they come to the school in clothes from home, right? In probably their very nicest clothes. Their parents dress them as well they can. And then those clothes are immediately taken off and you're thrown away or packed away. And they're given these school uniforms, which are basically military uniforms. I mean, these are, for a long while in the U.S. at least, these are functionally military schools. So that's your first day. Your first day, you've lost four cultural markers intentionally erased from you. A typical school day, you're going to wake up early, usually with bugles. I mean, it's a military school. Again, on the U.S. side, you're going to go to classroom studies, which would be reading, writing, arithmetic, history. But of course, history taught a certain way, right? Let's learn about how your people are savages and how we're saving you. And by the way, you can say thank you anytime you want to. The other part of the day is going to be industrial training, making you useful in some way. And because of resource shortages at the school, a large part of your day is actually providing labor for the schools. You're actually just prison labor, quite frankly, for these schools. Corporal punishment is very, very common, which most tribal nations don't use traditionally. And so you could be spank things that would not have seemed harsh to the white culture at the time, but also just really horrible physical abuse. I mean, I've read the diaries of superintendents where the guy is bragging about how he ended up breaking two buggy whips from just whipping the shit out of these runaway students. And he's proud of it. He's like, hot damn, I can do that again. I've read letters where the superintendents have to explain why they spent money on handcuffs. Well, it's because this kid, we had to handcuff him for his own good. You might be made to dress in girls' clothes if you're a boy and walk around in a dress, right? Because, again, these gender expectations for boys and girls are very much a part of these schools. Sexual abuse, right, is a huge problem, especially the Canadian schools, but at the U.S. schools as well. Of course, part of the problem here, right, is that survivors have to be willing to share those stories. So our sense of the abuse, sexual and physical, is probably way under what actually happened, especially because the ones that suffered the most didn't live to tell us the stories.
And you also see it in Canada, probably more so than here in the States. I feel like maybe the population is just larger of First Nations in Canada, but there's definitely horror stories of a lot of women that suffered crazy sexual abuse at the boarding schools.
Yep.
Of course, later fell into prostitution, especially in places like Vancouver. You definitely hear those stories about women that were in the boarding schools and the horror stories that they tell of that. And also young men, there's a ton of young men that have horror stories to tell. And even in that clip, that's from about a 30, 45 minute Canadian documentary about the residential schools. And it just, there's actually three people that it documents that tell their stories of it. And just that little clip was very hard to
watch. Yeah. And to this day, the demographic most likely to be sexually assaulted, most likely to be sexually trafficked, is Indigenous women in both countries. And that is part of the legacy of these schools.
Still.
Yes. One of the questions I actually would wanted to ask you, John, is that what was the vehicle or mechanism that basically got the children from their parents? How did they either physically take the kids or convince the parents to give the children to these schools? How what were the mechanisms that allowed the children to be conveyed to these institutions?
Sure. So part of it's just brute force. I mean, it's just show up, kidnap, right? That happens quite a bit. On the U.S. side, at least, another big mechanism is treaties. So you make these treaties with these tribes. You force them on these reservations. These reservations are largely shit land. And what you do is you withhold what you are supposed to give them by treaty until they send their kids, right? You know, we'd love to give you the corn. We'd love to give you this and this, but until we see a certain number of kids, you know, we can't give you anything, right? So you actually hold their kids hostage, right, for treaty obligations. That's a big part of it too. Some parents do send their kids voluntarily, right? Especially some leaders, because there is this sense of, look, this isn't going away, right? So we need to send some of our youth to learn how their legal system works, how their language works, what their culture is. But certainly in sending them, they're not making a calculated risk like, this is worth a little bit of sexual abuse. They don't know those kind of things are happening, right? And when they find that out, they make every effort to get their kids back with fairly limited success, right? Because, I mean, the governments hold all the power. They have the legitimate monopoly on force. They have all the resources they can withhold. I mean, it's just there's not a lot of ways to keep your kid out of the system.
This is incredible. So there were various, between the treaties and the actual forced takings, were the mechanisms they use to take the children to these schools.
Yeah.
So in terms of the situation in Canada, mm-hmm. what do you attribute the factors to these graves, and why is there a debate over what they're called? Was this something likable to maybe malnutrition, neglect, or was it just straight homicide? What exactly do you attribute to these deaths happening? Or was it just kind of death by cultural trauma? I mean, you know, a variety of things.
Sure. So, I mean, there are sociopaths at some of these schools, I'll just be honest, right? But for the most part, the major problem in both systems is that they're woefully underfunded. They do not have enough food. They do not have enough supplies, period. And to add to this problem is the only way to get more money is to have more students in the schools, right? So now you've got overcrowding. Now you've got sanitation issues. So these places are just disease cesspools. So you have psychologically traumatized, kidnapped children who aren't being fed enough, who aren't sleeping and eating and cleaning themselves in sanitary environments. And it's no surprise you end up with these graves, right? I mean, do some of the graves represent kids just straight up killed by too much corporal punishment, things like that? Sure, I'm sure it happened, absolutely. But the number of bodies should horrify us. But given the way these institutions are run, the body counts are not surprising. These are places where you expect people to die, right? You don't have to intentionally take their life. The environment itself is just not a place where young kids are going to be healthy.
So the next question I want to have is that what kind of reaction were the native, the First Nation tribes, was there ever any kind of contemporary, when these schools were functioning, mm-hmm. rebellion against these systems? Were there attempts to get this, get the kids back? Were there mm-hmm. attempts to for people to understand what was going on? What exactly was the reaction amongst the tribes? I want to say tribes, amongst the First Nations people to the treatment of their children.
Sure. I mean, on both sides of the border, there's definitely attempts to fight this system. There's attempts to use the courts at times, but in both countries, the legal system sees Indigenous peoples as not being citizens, as not really having any rights. You can't really use the legal system. You can try to straight up rebel or resist, which does happen at times. But by the time these schools are taking place, the military power of tribal nations on both sides of the border is pretty well broken, right? I mean, Carlisle opens in 1879. Geronimo is captured finally in the 1880s. And in 1890, you have the Wounded Knee Massacre, which is kind of the end of the Indian Wars. In Canada, I don't know the timeline as well, to be totally honest, but it's the same situation, right? There's no effective way to mount consistent violent resistance in any sort of successful manner at this point.
Based on the timing of the creation of these institutions, is it safe to say that one of the motivations behind them was to curtail the rebellious nature of the Native Americans or the threat that they posed to the settler colonial project?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Canadian system is that they're actually writing letters to each other, literally saying we should use these kids as hostages, right? That very much is part of it. Yeah, there absolutely is there. One of the commenters, Evil Yoda, says all the lands were on his shit land. You're right, Evil Yoda. I apologize. I spoke way too generally. I should have been very more careful in the way I said, so I apologize for that. You're right. But yeah, very much that's part of it, right? It's to keep these tribal nations in check. It's also to provide a way to take the remaining land, right? Because if you assimilate the children and you send them home, the idea is you're going to create a system of individual families rather than communal societies. And these individual families might take up a little bit of land, but they're not going to take up all the land claims of the tribal nations themselves.
I do want to ask you a little bit about, because again, we do have to kind of get into the weeds a little bit about some of these histories to give a little bit of context. The Dawes Act.
Yes.
Can you explain that to us, to the audience, just a little bit?
Yeah. Okay. So the Dawes Act, the Dawes Act is passed in 1887. As an historian, I think I'd be more confident with dates, but I'm pretty sure it's 1887. It's sponsored by a senator named Henry Dawes, and basically it's just another prong, honestly, of the same attack, settler colonial attack as the boarding schools. Right? There's this sense that Native American peoples, they're disappearing. They can't survive on their own. And one of the reasons they can't survive is because they're culturally backwards. So this communal living isn't going to work. As you look at some of the documents, they're actually complaining that the tribal nations aren't selfish enough, right? They don't have ambition. They don't have the right kinds of desires. And so the Dawes Act takes these reservations that have been promised, and it breaks them up by giving every head of household 160 acres. And so once every head of household is registered with 160 acres, then the rest of the reservation lands are sold off forcibly, not in negotiations with the tribe. And that money is supposed to go to education or other ways to help the tribes. Some of it does. A lot of it ends up in the hands of very corrupt people, as one might imagine. So the Dawes Act is really to destroy reservations, to free up land for white settlers, and to destroy indigenous communities by creating a bunch of individual nuclear selfish bastards. I guess that's kind of the goal. And that isn't reversed until the 1930s.
And how does the Bureau of American Indian, or is it the Bureau of Indian Affairs, play into all this?
I mean, well, they're the government arm in charge of dealing with relations with Native Americans. So they're overseeing a lot of this. They oversee the schools. They oversee registration of what's called the Dawes Rolls. So if you're going to break up these reservations, you've got to go and see who's living there, who are the heads of family, who are citizens of these tribes. And so it's a very sloppy, terrible, not well done process. But the result is these Dawes Rolls, which have their own tortured legacy because they are used for some tribal nations to determine citizenship today. And it's just kind of messy because a lot of people purposely avoided being on the Dawes Rolls because the government says, we're going to put your name down on a piece of paper. You know, maybe there are reasons not to cooperate.
A side note on that, there is a bit of an issue about people claiming Native heritage to get government funds.
Yep.
And we definitely see I'll have to find the article and M. Toussaint, if you can find it. I know it's in the LA Times. It's an article. I think it came out a couple years ago talking about the majority of people that are getting the funds for these, like, there's like a fund for, and it's, I'm talking hundreds of millions of dollars for Native Americans to do like construction for government contracts.
Sure. And
these non-recognized tribes that look like a bunch of white people.
Sure.
And how, so how does the Dawes play into that? These unrecognized tribes getting, being able to get government funds.
Yeah. So, boy, this is really, this is messy stuff.
Sorry.
All right. No, no, it's great to talk about. Okay. So to get certain benefits from the federal government, and they're not handouts, right? They're treaty obligations. You have to be federally recognized as a tribe. Some tribes are state recognized. And so there's a lot at stake in being federally recognized, right? You're treated as a politically sovereign unit within the federal system. You're given access to federal fundings for healthcare, for education, different things like that, and to contracts, business contracts, things like that, that are set aside for Native people. So what you have is kind of a messy situation. So on the one hand, you have tribal groups who seem to have a legitimate historical record, right? But the government, with its arbitrary definitions of Indian, won't recognize them. At the same time, you definitely have individuals who are forming 501Cs, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, and calling themselves Native American nations. Like, yeah, we're a band of the Hoosawatsits. We've always been around, and so fraud's a real problem here. I mean, this is a messy thing, right? Because when you talk about group identity, it's connected to political sovereignty, it's connected to economic resources, it's connected to cultural linguistic preservation, right? So who gets to say they are Native American? There's a hell of a lot at stake in that question.
That's why I bring it up, because it also, for me, frames my kind of objection to the ADOS argument. There's other reasons, but I was always like, well, who gets to be black? And why don't you talk to Native Americans about who gets to be Native and who gets these benefits?
Right.
You know, because I think working in the, I guess we would call it the West. What would you call North Dakota?
It's called the Midwest, or the frozen Midwest or something.
the tundra. Working in North Dakota, I'd never seen racism like that, so blatant, vocal. The West, I saw it too in certain parts of Arizona when it came to indigenous people. And there is a notion that they all get free money from the government,
right?
Just for being who they are. And the reason why they're poor is because they're just shitty people that don't take advantage of their free magical government money. And again, being, I don't want to get too much into why I was in this environment with a bunch of Native cats in the Dakotas, but hearing their firsthand accounts of how that shit just ain't real really blew my mind. Because people truly believe, like, oh, then they get free money. The casino money. They all have a casino, right?
Right. They all have oil and casinos, all of them. So,
Yes.
Somebody in the comments asked several times now if I was making fun of the Lumbee. No, nothing I said should be construed as that. If you don't know what that means, that's totally fine. But just so that watcher isn't concerned, no, I'm not mocking the Lumbee at all.
The interesting thing about these perceptions that you were talking about, Jason, is that all you have to do is peruse a casual demographic data on quality of life statistics of Native Americans vis-a-vis, you know, alcohol abuse, vis-a-vis, you know, mass incarceration, vis-a-vis crime, vis-a-vis all of that stuff, domestic violence. And they're probably one of the few communities that have worse numbers than Black Americans in many contexts.
It blew me away because I didn't know. I'll be honest, and I'm probably going to sound stupid, and people will make Jason so dumb comments. I don't care. I didn't fucking grow up around a goddamn reservation. So what the fuck am I really supposed to know about what reservation life is supposed to be until I get to one, goddamn it? But I remember being on a Greyhound bus, because I don't like flying, taking a Greyhound bus from Oakland, California to Williston, North Dakota, and it's not a straight shot. And somewhere around Bismarck, we had a stop on the bus, and I got out. We got to get out to like a little convenience store to get snacks, and a black woman had walked out, and she was the first black woman I saw in 2 days. I stopped her, asked what she was doing there. She says she worked there, and she was talking to me, and I was like, are white people cool here? She goes, oh, yeah, for the most part, man, you have nothing to worry about. She goes, they hate natives more than us.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
It was. And there's a lot of truth in that statement.
So, John, one of the questions I want to ask you relative to this as well is that in light of this particular history being exposed in the contemporary moment, how do you think, as a historian, does this complicate the current battle that we're seeing with states that are fighting against the historical narratives of America as a nation that aren't particularly rooted in romantic examples of American exceptionalism and pie in the sky, the great frontier? In other words, the fact that conservatives in various states like Texas, as Jason mentioned earlier, are trying to strip any type of narrative that discusses the tortured racial, social, and settler colonial history of America from academic institutions. How exactly do we jive this new development with that particular movement? How is the discourse being rendered in academic circles? How do you see this playing out? Jason, if you want to add any comments?
No. I'm going to shut up and listen.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing it does is it reminds us, right, that America's history is not just black and white. And that's sort of the focus for a lot of...
Excuse the pun, right? That's an excuse the pun, right?
That's right. That's right. Excuse the pun. If whatever makes you sound smarter, that's what I meant. So we'll go with that. But I think it challenges a lot of the same myths that the current hysteria, right, over everything that is race, the CRT apparently, is stirring up in people. Look, I tell my students sometimes, I'm like, look, you live in a country that's an extraordinary experiment and freedom and liberty, and it's built on the backs of slave labor and the genocide of Native Americans. You have to deal with that. You have to deal with that reality, that this was an experiment that was not meant for everyone at the beginning. It sure as hell was not. And it was an experiment that was justified by making others less than human, right? I mean, even in the 1776 Commission, they literally talk about one of the things that should unify us is that together we conquered or tamed the wilderness, right? I mean, that's phenomenal. It's like, look, let's focus on things we have in common, like the fact that we tamed the wilderness. Well, no, what you did is you invaded people's homes, took their stuff, forcibly assimilated their children, sterilized the women up through the 1970s, by the way, right? I mean, it's just, it's phenomenal that we're given this all or nothing history, right? You either must acknowledge the United States is amazing and glorious and exceptional and freedom, blah, 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 white people rape slaves, it's not really important, or you want to destroy the nation, right? Those are your two choices, apparently. And it's extraordinary. And what I hope is that these, especially as Secretary Holland's initiative on the schools, opens up another front on this, right? Like, all right, you want to talk about slavery for a second? That's fine. Let's talk about genocide, right? So that's my hope. He says in his grumpy old man rant. So.
Well, the question for me particularly is that with this politicization of history, mm-hmm. is that, you know, as a historian, I ask you this sincerely, is the project of the nation state so built in mythology that the capacity for true rendition of history becomes impossible?
I mean, yeah, I would say yes, right? So Benedict Anderson got into a lot of this in his Imagined Communities, right? But the... The nation state wants to see itself as both being a natural organization for humanity, and it's not, but also as being sort of an inevitable, right? The progress of history led to the nation state. That's the way we tell our own story, right? This happened, and it was all leading to the United States. Other countries do the same thing, right? It was all leading to France. It was all leading to Great Britain. So we see the nation state as sort of the end of history, right? To use the title of a somewhat interesting book, right? The end of history. And so I don't think it works because the nation state is not, it's not natural. We're, as human beings, we're not wired to swear allegiance to nation state contracts, I don't think. Doesn't mean it can't be used for positive stuff, I guess, but it's just hard to keep it tenable.
I mean, my beef, and I don't know if you feel the same way, Pascal, those like Time Life books, reason why it was like on my mind is because I remember touring through places like Montana, and I like thrift shops, and you go to these small town USA, you can find cool shit at little thrift shops, right, for a couple bucks. And one thing that I found kind of constant when I went through certain parts of the country was that Time Life book set was always at a thrift shop.
Wow.
With those paintings. Who's the guy? Maybe someone in the chat knows, if no one on the show knows. Who's the guy that made those kind of great big paintings of like the Manifest Destiny paintings of like some majestic fucking cowboy slaughtering?
You about Remington? Is that who you mean?
Yes. That some bitch. Like, Remington shit everywhere, or Remington-esque shit everywhere.
The Thomas Kincaid of the American exceptionalism, basically, yes.
By the way, this is, I'm glad you mentioned that. Can you explain for our audience, by the way, that the concept of American exceptionalism is really like a post-World War II kind of reality, that it's not something that kind of originates, you know, sua sponte out of the birth of the nation? What are the origins of the concept, and when it really becomes popularized? Do you feel confident in discussing that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, so from the beginning, the United States wants to see itself as different than Europe, right? There's this sort of kid brother syndrome, and one of the ways they want to distinguish themselves is that they're not going to expand through to tyranny and conquest. They're going to have what Jefferson calls an empire of liberty. And he doesn't mean that ironically. He really means an empire, and he really means based on liberty. How that works, I mean, you can ask him, right? So from the beginning, you have this sense of we're not going to be like the other guys. We're not going to do it in the same way. And so I think that idea, I think it grows over time. It can really be found in like Teddy Roosevelt's foreign policy. It can certainly be found, and if you look at World War I, right? Why does Wilson say we're going to war? To make the world safe for democracy. There's this sense of the U.S. has a moral responsibility as a defender and promoter of democracy. So even before like the phrase is created, you definitely have this sense of the United States as a unique nation with a unique history that gives it political but also moral superiority, which gives it certain obligations on the world stage, right? I mean, hell, even when Obama was talking about maybe possibly there being some sort of red line in Syria, he uses the language of American exceptionalism to explain why the U.S. might get involved in Syria. 2016 campaign, Trump and Clinton both used that kind of language. So it's still the foundation, I think, of U.S. self-perception, not only of its own history, but also its role in the world.
Do you think that that narrative is fundamentally tied into the pretext America uses to act as an empire in its projects all over the globe?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Right. I mean, the project, the nation building in Iraq, for example, that is an American exceptionalism model. We promote democracy, which everyone should want. And by the way, where there's democracy, there's automatically a free market, which is great for us because now you'll buy all our shit, which is great. We have to export to keep the system alive, right? But yeah, there really is this sense of America being unique, morally and politically unique. It is superior to other countries. I mean, you hear this from the conservative media all the time. You list all these national sins, all these problems. They'll be like, yeah, point conceded, but this is still the greatest nation of all time. And if you don't say that back, you don't say, yeah, maybe for some people, or it's got some things going for it, then you are not a patriot.
The running joke in a Chris Rock movie from, I want to say it was the late 90s, Head of State, where he's the guy running for president, is they always have to say, God bless America and nowhere else. Remember that movie, Pascal?
I do remember that movie. Well, you know, I find I've always found that this kind of blind patriotic narrative, you know, that is replete, not exclusively in the United States, but in the Nation State Project,
sure,
fundamentally premised on mendacity, lies, and ignorance. And I think that, you know, part of patriotism, when you're dealing with an empire like the United States, is premised on moral cajoling of people into believing things that are fundamentally untrue. Because when you're exposed to the truth of the nation, then you have to really start to wrestle with the fact of how exactly are you going to make the plea that this place is morally superior.
Right. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, no one wants to say, might makes right is the reason we exist, right? We want to say there was some divine destiny, or there was some moral superiority that is why we exist and other empires don't, or why we defeat other people. So every empire and every nation state is going to have this founding mythology that it has to have to justify on ethical grounds why this project ought to exist and why it ought to continue.
Someone's asking, can you lay out the difference between a nation and a state? It's an interesting question.
Sure. So the way that like political scientists usually use the term is that a nation refers to an ethnic group, right? Whereas a state refers to the political organization, like the country that nation forms. So nation state is a combination of an ethnic nation with its own political structures. I mean, that's the way that political scientists tend to use the terms. I'm probably going to get an angry email from my colleagues at MSU who are listening, but that's the gist of the distinction there. So functionally, the way we talk in everyday life, there's not really a distinction we're trying to make very much. That's technically the difference.
Thank you for the super chat, Jeremy. Shout out to Jeremy for helping us with movie night.
That was a quick hour, man.
I think I decided what movie I want to do for movie night. Close. I'm thinking we do Black Widow. It's just White Shaft. And we'll cover that. So, because it's like $30 to watch, like we'll do it so people can watch it for free. And then we'll deconstruct if it really is anti-Soviet Union propaganda. What do you say?
I'm flexible.
And yes, I said it. Black Widow is White Shaft. Go ahead.
You heard it here first.
You heard it first.
Well, John, one thing we didn't ask you yet is that are you able to do a patrons only session with us after our hour, which is basically over, where we can maybe for a half hour or so, or maybe a little longer?
Sure, I'd be happy to stick around. That'd be fine.
Jeremy says Black Widow's like 2 hours and 10 minutes. It doesn't matter, Jeremy. First of all, I'm trying to bless everybody with a free $30 movie. That's the only way I can stick it to the man, is by showing people as many motherfuckers as possible a $30 movie.
Sounds like ingratitude to me from your patrons. That's unfortunate.
And
Janice Graham had a question that we should ask in the second hour. It's scrolled down the screen. Janice, re-ask your question in the patron section so we can address it.
So it's going to take me give me a couple minutes, guys, to get the link up. Restream is they're having some technical difficulties right now with the ability for me to create these links a little quicker. So give me about 5 to 7 minutes and I will have a new link. Professor Graham, thank you so much for agreeing to come back on. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, that's great. Whenever conversations go fast, to me, that's usually an indication that it was a good show. And this hour flew by.
It did. I'm shocked. It's 9 o'clock. Yeah. Or 9 o'clock where I am.
Well, you know, also too, again, from the first time you were on, Professor Graham, a lot of things have changed about the show. One big thing is there is a moderator that's not just a moderator, but moderates all the big shows in this lefty YouTube sphere and is kind of amazing at it and really controls the vibe of this chat on a whole nother level. So always utmost fucking props. Shout out.
For the super chat. We did mention Michael Brooks in the beginning of the show.
There you go. Shots fired because our moderator's so dope. Yes, we did. Oh, okay, Pascal. Yeah, we did talk about Michael Brooks in the beginning of the show. And on that note, we are out.